The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest exciting edition of Life on Planet Porky with myself, of course, the Porkmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, how are we this fine day?
Yeah, absolutely sparkling here, Michael.
Yes,
thank you very much.
Absolutely. Our old colleague Piers Morgan, right? Two shows now, okay? Both dominated by Donald Trump, but Piers in imperious form, I would say. You've got a particular interest, haven't you, in Piers, apart from the fact that he's been a colleague of ours for a good 30 years in Fleet Street and television. But I understand you focused on him in your new blockbuster bestseller due out quite soon.
Well, Piers, my favourite boss of all time. You know, he hired me to work for him at the News of the World, where I had a column, a celebrity feature, double spread every week for some time before he left to go to the Daily Mirror. I've got a lot of time for Piers. He's a very grounded bloke.
Yes.
You know, he might be being projected as a global celebrity right now, and all power to him. But whenever you see him, bump into him in a bar or memorial service or something, he's just the same Piers as he always
was.
Yes,
I agree.
So it's, you know, the professionalism is an act, but he does have his feet on the ground. I really admire him for that.
Oh, yeah, I do as well.
He hasn't gone to his head. But yes, he is in my new book, which is called The Stone Age,
right.
60 Years of the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
And in fact, he features in a few places. He was particularly championing the band's cause when the Wokies came out against the song Brown Sugar.
Right.
Saying that it was racist and sexist and all the other criticisms.
Down in New Orleans. That one, yeah.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. But yeah, he said some very sensible stuff about why we shouldn't be cancelling rock songs of that nature at the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's got a platform there, so I'm interested in talking to him about
that. Oh, absolutely. That would be terrific. Yeah. No, I totally agree with you, Piers being grounded. He and I fell out a few years ago, right, over...
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, over Arsenal. Because Piers is a very enthusiastic Arsenal fan, but brutally honest about their achievements. And when Arsene Wenger, who was the greatest manager Arsenal have ever had for, well, in their history, when he started failing season after season, Piers started getting on his back. So I hit out against him on Twitter saying you shouldn't treat a legend like Arsene Wenger with the sort of, you know, comments you're making about him now. You know, he gave you the greatest era of Arsenal's lifetime. And it got more and more bitter. And then in the end, we stopped talking to each other. But about a year later, something else happened. We had to get in touch. And it was like it had never happened. You know what I mean? In fact, he said, really, Mike? He said, I can't even remember that. You know what I mean? So it's not a bloke who goes around harbouring grudges or anything like that, you know?
There's something else I really admire about him, that he, you know, he leaves it on the office desk, as it were. He doesn't make this ever a personal vendetta.
Yes. No,
and that's really important when you're in a position like his.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. But anyway, I'm sure that will bounce on and on and on. Listen, the current story at the moment, which I think has been blown completely out of proportion, is the issue surrounding Angela Rayner. Now, you and I have talked about Angela Rayner, the Labour deputy leader, on this very podcast before, and I've said I think she's a very attractive woman. And And now, I mean, just to recap for our millions of listeners, some anonymous Tory MP apparently told the political editor of the Mail on Sunday that Angela Rayner sometimes gets out on the terrace to have a drink and is alleged to have made comments saying she deliberately crosses and uncrosses her legs when she's sitting on the front bench in the House of Commons to try and distract Boris Johnson, a man who is known for his appreciation of the female form. And this story was published in the Mail on Sunday. I think Glenn Owen, the political editor, published it. So he's a man who's you know, dealt with many, many serious political stories over the years. And now the whole world's blown up. I think it was a bit of tittle-tattle gossip, isn't it, that, you know, just got blown out of all proportion.
Well, where it went wrong is that it should never have been written about in the Mail on Sunday in the first place. They went down a very slippery slope on that score because it is grossly sexist to make such comments. It's interesting, somebody reversed this and said, you know, if we applied the same scandalous rules to Boris Johnson, for example, somebody who's had at least six children by however many different women, who cavorted with a pole dancer, who has lied in Parliament on numerous occasions, allegedly, this, that, and the other. If you just reverse that and apply the same criticism in sexist terms to him, it wouldn't happen. Mm. This has been blown up because she's a female, because she is physically attractive, and there seems to be some resentment towards her. She's only, what, 44 or something? She's deputy Labour leader. Yeah. She could well be prime minister in years to come. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it was inappropriate of the Mail on Sunday to publish this coverage. And, I do think also that they're talking now about taking Glenn Owen's pass away, aren't they?
Oh, they're talking about summoning him in front of the Speaker.
He has been summoned. Yeah. He has been summoned by the Speaker. But if they take his lobby pass away, I think that is contrary to the rules of journalism, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. People might not like the story, but it's a story he thought worth writing. Perhaps they should have written it the other way around. You and I know how to turn stories around. Perhaps he should have written it about the anger on the Labour benches at, you know, an insinuation rather than stating it as fact. Because the headline said, you know, related it to the Sharon Stone incident, you know, in Basic Instinct. And it was almost written like kind of fact, if you see what I mean. Look, I've seen plenty of pictures of Angelina sitting on the front bench with what I would call, you know, a very daring sort of skirt, either split at the side or a short skirt, all of which she's entitled to wear. She's a woman. She follows fashion and she's very attractive and all that kind of stuff. But I still think it could have been laughed off without all this terribly, you know, serious, you know, it's disgraceful and all that kind of stuff. Surely it's just somebody saying, you know, flirtations happen in the House of Commons or whatever.
I suppose it begs the question that should men and women be following a code of appropriate dress in office?
Yeah, maybe. Well, I don't think a dress was inappropriate. You know, I mean, I'm all for women flashing legs if they've got nice legs without sounding sexist myself.
Well, that is quite a sexist thing to say. I'm sure that women do that in certain situations. What I'm asking is that appropriate in the House of Commons? Yeah. Should we not be focusing on the job in hand? And should there be some sort of dress code to avoid this sort of situation arising?
Yeah, look, down the centuries, men have always got away with it because all they have to do is wear a suit. And women have to be a lot more careful about what they wear because they know they're going to be commented upon. Just got to look at the way the royal family have to spend hours and hours dressing themselves up to turn out when they are on official duty. Now, talking about women and politics, right, I worked in the last few days with Edwina Curry, and I have to say how impressed I was with her, honestly. Really, you know, very formidable intellect. She went to St. Anne's College, Oxford, which we were talking about, and she was a politician whose career was cut short, actually, by this salmonella comment she made. She was a junior health minister. But nevertheless, you know, she's had a pretty outstanding career in many different forms. She's a very successful, like you are, best-selling author. And at 76, I have to say she had the vibrancy and energy of a woman much younger as we debated issues like electric cars and all that kind of stuff, you know. I don't know if you've ever met her.
I haven't, but please tell me that you quizzed her on John Major's Tesco's underpants.
Well, I didn't have to, because we were sitting on the couch there. This is at GB News. And, you know, the issue came up about politicians. I think Angela Rayner came up, actually. Or did that not happen by the... Yes, it had. It happened that morning, actually, yeah.
Be careful how you say that.
Yes, exactly. And the story I meant had been published that morning. And so, inevitably, Mark Dolan, the presenter, had to sort of, you know, tiptoe, well, he didn't really tiptoe, about Edwina and relations in the House of Commons between opposite sides of the chamber, but between men and women. And, of course, she immediately volunteered. Well, of course, I've got a lot of experience of that. And then Mark said, yes, you had a brief sort of friendship, didn't you, with John Major? Edwina said,
that's one way of putting it.
Yeah. Edwina said, oh, no, it wasn't brief. She said it lasted between 3.5 and 4 years, which I didn't know. I mean, crikey, can you imagine that going on for 3.5, 4 years? John Major's wife and Edwina's...
I mean, you've got to feel sorry for Norma, haven't you,
definitely.
Really? But
yeah.
When she did her diaries, and I remember this was back in 2002, so it's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
She got £200,000 advance for her diaries.
Yeah.
And they were serialised in the Times, and they reckon she made more than £1 million in sales. But the revelations that really carried that book were the fact that John Major wore Tesco underpants, and that he tucks his shirt into his pants when he gets dressed. I mean, really, doesn't that sort of drag politics down into the dirt?
Well, it does. But if you can cash in on it after you come out of politics, that's what all politicians do. I was amazed to read that Theresa May has now picked up over £1 million in speaking engagements since she stepped down as Prime Minister, and she's still a backbench MP in the House. Mind you, what Theresa May has got to say that is interesting, I simply cannot imagine. Would you pay £1,000 a plate at a dinner to sit down and, you know, have the rubber chicken circuit dinner and then listen to Theresa May talking for 40 minutes?
Well, no, I wouldn't. But should this be allowed? If she's a working, sitting politician...
Yeah, I agree. Good question.
Should she be allowed to be engaging in these very lucrative speaking engagements?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I you know, it's a point I've often raised in the past, the cashing in on public service. People say, oh, I go into public service to serve the community, to serve my constituents. Well, you're not serving your constituents if you're at late-night dinners giving people the benefit of your wisdom for maybe £25,000 because you have work to do the following morning for your constituents. So I totally agree with you. But I also know the point you're making. You carry state secrets in your head, don't you?
Oh, not only in your head, but I mean, she's very swift to damn Boris and the rest of the cabinet currently, and she's very disapproving and looking down her nose in Parliament all the time for understandable reasons.
Yeah.
In which case, step down from the job, give somebody else a go, off you go, write your diaries, and then do the dinner circuit.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, David Cameron, to be fair to him, the minute he knew the game was up for him because he lost the Brexit vote, he just came out of Downing Street, stood at the lectern and said, right, I'm off. Now, you can look at that two ways. One, he should have stayed and actually represented the country in the Brexit negotiations, but he felt he couldn't, so he disappeared. But he didn't stick around for his constituents either. I think it was it Wanton in Oxfordshire or something? His somewhere in Oxfordshire, I think.
That way inclined, yes. I lost a lot of respect.
He just packed up. And, of course, these days now, his life is meaningless. The last picture I saw of him, he's sitting on the steps of his shepherd's caravan, you know, and he can't find anything to do in life. Getting back to Edwina, it was utterly fascinating, and you'd have loved it, Leslie-Ann, because, of course, we're both, you know, big fans of the Beatles. And she talked about the days at the Cavern when she got to know Lennon and McCartney, you know, and...
I wonder if they wear Tesco's underpants as well.
I've no idea. I don't think it was that sort of relationship, to be honest.
She said euphemistically.
Yeah, she's 3 years younger than Paul. So, because he's 80 this year, and I think she's...
He's going to be 80 in June.
That's right, and she's 77 this year. So, she went to a really good school. I don't think it was the Institute. She mentioned another school. I think it might have been a girls' school. But what they do is they take off at lunchtime because those great concerts the Beatles did, great shows or whatever, they were lunchtime shows, weren't they? in the cavern.
Yeah, a lot of all the office girls used to go down there in their lunch hour.
That's it. Well, she used to.
They didn't play for longer than about 20 minutes in those days.
Yes, that's right. So so she and a friend would leave school and get the bus across town to Matthew Street, where the cavern is, and they took with them a roll-top polo, black polo jumper. See what I mean? And they put that on over their school uniform because they didn't want to look like schoolgirls. You know what I mean? And then they danced away for, you know, 30 or 40 minutes in the cavern with all the, you know, perspiration dropping off the walls and all that kind of stuff. And then went back to school afterwards. And the person who took their school blazers at the door was Cilla Black. I mean, isn't that amazing?
Well, yeah, Cilla always denied that she was a hat check girl at the cavern, interestingly.
Right.
Quite a lot of people do have memories of her having done yeah. that. But, yeah, it didn't figure in her memory bank, let's say.
No.
But I can't understand that thing of girls getting a bus at lunchtime and going across town to see a gig. When I was at school, yeah. we were not allowed off the school premises.
No, well, she wasn't.
And if you were,
she wasn't.
Yeah, but if you were caught, yeah. that was major, major detention.
Absolutely. That was the same with us. I went to the King's School Chester, and our school was on a site out of town about a mile down the Wrexham Road. So it was on a greenfield site, and it was surrounded by fields and ditches and fences and all that kind of stuff. So to get out, you had to make a serious effort to get over the fence or through the hedge or something like that to escape to the pub, which is what we used to do. At the back of the school, there was a little village. It was all on the Duke of Westminster's estate, by the way, okay? The huge Eaton Hall estate owned by the Duke of Westminster. And within that estate, there was a tiny village down a track at the back of the school. And you had to get over the fence and across a ditch to get away from the school. And then it was a walk down a farm track to the pub around the corner where all the farm labourers were. And we got caught once. We did it, you know, regularly all the time. But then on one occasion, the following day, the head teacher walked into the room, "Stand up, the boys who went over the fence yesterday." And of course, because we were all honourable people, we stood up. And you're absolutely right. We got 4 hours of detention. And my mum and dad went ballistic, you know, at my misbehaviour. Weren't so much worried about the drinking, but having been disciplined by the headmaster. But you're right, it used to happen all the time.
It's very interesting because I had quite an easy ride as a parent.
Right.
I think I was a bit kind of a good girl at school, yep. really. I didn't get into trouble very much. Only on April Fool's Day, mm-hmm. when we used to reorganise the school timetable and send everybody to the wrong classrooms. And my favourite trick was always putting cling film over the toilet bowl.
Oh, dear.
Lift up the seat and
oh,
then
Miss
put the cling
Jones,
film
I can't believe you took part in such a seedy,
of course I did.
Sordid... absolutely revolting trick like that. Honest to God,
I'm
sorry. My view of you has changed absolutely completely now, Miss Jones, you know?
Yeah. My kids were pretty good, I have to say.
Yeah.
But they did go to very good schools and expectations of them were very, very high.
Yeah.
But they didn't give me much trouble, to be honest. I think I got away with it there as a mum,
yeah.
to be honest.
Yeah, well, maybe you did. Now, Miss Jones, you are, of course, a legendary survivor of Live Aid. And I saw a poll recently. It says the Live Aid gig 1985 has been voted the event most people wish they had attended. So you are very select in the fact that you were not only there, you were on the stage, you were backstage, you were with the stars. I think you went there with a member of the Queen group. But it says that is the event that everybody now of our sort of generation wishes they had been at. But you've looked back on it many times, haven't you, with great affection?
I have. It was an extraordinary day. And I actually went to Live Aid, to Wembley Stadium,
yeah.
with John Entwistle of The Who, the bass player in The Who,
yeah.
Sadly departed now, and his girlfriend Maxine, who were very good friends of mine.
Right.
I stayed with them at their house in Roehampton the night before, and we went in John's converted Rolls Royce to Wembley
yeah.
Stadium. I was in the boot. He had it converted to fit his Irish wolfhound
yes.
called Fitz Perfectly was its name.
Yeah.
And I had to go in the boot with the dog, which was an interesting experience.
Well, then it was.
But it was an extraordinary day.
Yeah.
I remember so much about it. I remember two things really in particular, that David Bowie was the outstanding solo act of the day.
I thought it was
but
Queen.
The Queen as a band.
Yeah. Well, Freddie Mercury is an individual, surely.
Well, David Bowie as a solo act was the best on the day, and Queen as a band were the best band on the day. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Yes, Freddie stole it. It was their it was their day. And they had been sort of winding up as a band after about 15 years. They were all involved in solo projects. Yeah. They had solo albums going on. They'd had a difficult year the year before. They were talking about splitting up. They weren't getting on that that well. Mm. But Live Aid restored their reputation.
Yeah.
And so they went, they had another second or second wind. Mm. And off they went out on the Magic Tour the following year. But it was kind of game over for them by now because they didn't realize that Freddie was about to become so cool.
Yeah.
But I don't have sad memories of that day because of it. I have exuberant memories.
Oh, absolutely.
Just the crowd was extraordinary. Yeah. Just the goodwill was incredible. Yeah. And the effect that it had on the world at the time.
Yeah,
if you remember that we had no technology to speak of.
No, I totally agree. It was an amazing feeling. I mean, I watched it, you know, at my sister's in Surrey. All the doors and windows were open into the back garden, and it completely dominated, you know, everybody's thoughts and concentrations. And, you know, it must have been an amazing experience. The other votes for the other events go like this, okay? Number two, World Cup Final 1966. I can vouch for that one. I was at Wembley that year, 1966, but it was the FA Cup Final between Everton and Sheffield Wednesday. I didn't go to the World Cup Final. Number three, the Beatles' rooftop concert. You'd be given anything, wouldn't you, to have been there. Number four, the Queen's coronation. Not really bothered about that. Number five, Prince Charles and Princess Diana's wedding. I was at that, but I was on Fleet Street. I was an observer. We had 30 reporters around London on the route of the royal carriage, and I was positioned actually on Fleet Street just outside the Daily Express, and I got a great story about a bloke who made a fortune selling periscopes to see over the crowd.
I remember that story.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. What's the next one? Woodstock, number six. Well, I don't like huge festivals, so that wouldn't deter me on. That was in 1969. Number seven, Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip's wedding in 1947. Couldn't really care about that. Number eight, Adele at Glastonbury 2016. Does that mean anything?
I suppose it does. I mean, Glastonbury. I had an opportunity to go to Glasgow this year to see Paul McCartney.
Oh, right.
Who's headlining, and I turned it down. My daughter's going instead.
Oh, great.
I could not stand in a field with thousands of people standing up all day. You've got to go on an hour and a half hike to get to a toilet. Yeah. Then there's a queue.
Oh, yeah, forget
it. The conditions are very unpleasant.
No, I
just think beyond 30,
you
know, festivals are not really the thing.
No. I totally agree with you. And the last one is the first Olympic Games, 1896. Well, you'll have to say, I wouldn't be queuing up to go to that one either.
Well, it wasn't very thrilling. I had a look at this.
Oh, yeah.
The first modern Games this was, because the original Games took place in 776 BC.
In ancient Greece,
Yeah, the first modern Games in April 1896. But they only had 280 participants from 12 nations, and there were only 43 events. Mm. So it couldn't have been that thrilling, could it, really?
No, exactly. And why anybody would want to have been there anyway, I don't know. My tooth is still killing me, Miss Jones. I don't know what to do about it, honestly.
What the hell is going on with your tooth?
No idea.
Why have you not taken this dentist to task now?
Well, he's been my dentist for 25 years. I've never had a problem with him. He's really embarrassed about it, but he won't take out...
Well, perhaps he's gone off. Maybe you need to see another dentist.
I have. I've seen a guy in Harley Street, and I'm up in Harley Street again this week for a second consultation with the, you know, the expert who did the root canal stuff, which didn't work. He won't. The doc won't take out the tooth, which I now think is hurting, because he says it can't be that tooth. There are no nerves in it. It's not a real tooth. It's an implant. It's fixed onto an aluminium pin into your gum. There are no nerves in it. It can't be hurting you. He's adamant it can't be. So
something is hurting you. There will be somebody in the dental community out there who can fix this.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I would go public with it and invite people to come forward.
That's not a bad idea, you know.
You know, go on television and appeal to the best dentists in the country, in the world. You'll fly anywhere to get this fixed.
No, that's a good idea. I mean, I've had all the x-rays from every angle, and they want to find out whether I've got a hairline fracture of my gum or my jaw or a hairline fracture in the tooth next door, which is leading to this one. And it, you know, late at night sometimes, and I've had my dinner and I bite on something, you know, I don't know, a bit of cheese or something, or even a grape, and then I get this shot of electricity in my mouth, and it's very disconcerting, you know what I mean? I mean, look...
You've got to get this fixed, yeah, Mike. I mean, it's affecting your quality of life.
It's affecting the way I eat, and it's affecting my digestion, and it is affecting my mental health, because I think this is like... You know, it's like somebody's punishing me and I can't get rid of it and all that. Look, there are a lot of people in the world much worse off than me now, but this is just a constant torment, and constant torments play on your mind, don't they?
Well, it's in your head.
Yeah, it's like,
your teeth are in your head, and this is, yeah, you can never get away from,
yeah,
this.
I know.
This is in danger of sending you around the bed.
It is.
So I would do this. I would go on a quest, yeah, to find, yeah, the person who can cure your pain.
Yeah, the thing is, I'm worried about upsetting my dentist. You know, he'll think he's failed me.
No. Yeah. You can't think like that. He hasn't fixed, yeah, it. So with the best will in the world, you've got to find somebody who can.
Yeah, no, I think I'll have to think about that one. Okay, folks, this episode is brought to you by Surfshark, as have recent podcasts here at Life on Planet Porky, and we're enjoying a great relationship. Right, the internet is getting more dangerous by the second. Hackers have more ways to target you. Trackers are following your every move. And malware is hiding all over the web. Now, luckily, there is a solution. You can get a VPN. It will hide your real location, making you more difficult to identify and target. But privacy and security are not all that Surfshark has to offer. If you use a VPN, you will forget about geo restrictions. You'll be able to access everything from news sources to social media apps that are unavailable to you because of your location. Now, just change your virtual location and access all the entertainment you want safely and securely. And you can try out Surfshark completely risk-free because they have a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/porky. Use the promo code PORKY for 83% off and 3 extra months free. So that's surfshark.deals/porky.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in today. I have to say, Miss Jones, once again, isn't it nice to get all the feedback from our listeners, millions of them around the world, and very, very decent of them to show their appreciation for what we do.
Absolutely love hearing from listeners. It's what makes this podcast work.
Yeah.
And, you know, suggestions, praise, criticism, yeah, whatever it is, yeah, we love hearing from you.
That's right, yeah. Now then, you, of course, are a pop expert, Miss Jones, rock chick writer extraordinaire. So,
I wonder what you said then.
Yeah, exactly. So here we are. Identify this tune. We are the cheeky girls. You are the cheeky boys. We are the cheeky girls. Do you remember that?
Oh, my God. Yeah. That was, you know, one of the poorest excuses for a pop record that ever crossed my radar, I
That's
think.
That's right.
The cheeky girls, whatever happened to them?
Well, funny you should ask that, because I just picked up on a piece and the cheeky girls are back.
Please, no. Please, I'll pay anything.
Listen to this. Oh, the cheek of it. They are pop's greatest survivors after flying by the seat of their famous hot pants. The Cheeky Girls were panned on a TV talent show as teen wannabe jokes in 2002, but went on to storm the charts. But I mean, they are the original one record hit wonders who shouldn't have had a hit record and should never have been heard of again, should they? And I'm not trying to be unkind to those two young girls. They're Romanian, by the way, but they were the original flash in the pan.
Well, they must be about 40 now.
They're 44, I think, I read.
Oh, yeah, I mean, what for? Find something else to do.
Well, I totally agree. They're talking about making a comeback, but I just don't get it. They were on a show called Pop Idols, you know, which was that thing put together by Pete Waterman.
Yeah. It was the sort of forerunner of the X Factor.
Yes, that's right.
It
was. Yeah, and they didn't even win it; they came second. But the song was so catchy, their mother entered them in the show and wrote the song. Although she's got no musical talent, how you can write a song from nothing, I don't know. But
well, it pretty much shows you anyone can write a song. Yes. If you've got a subject. I mean, really. But it's all about publicity.
Yeah.
And didn't they really capture the public imagination because one or both of them was having an affair with Lembit Opic?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Now, I knew Lembit quite well for years. In fact, I still do. You know, and he was, I think he was a Lib Dem MP at the time. Used to carry, Lembit Opic used to carry a mouth organ around in his top pocket. And anytime anybody.
I thought you were going to say in his mouth, because no. He had that weirdest face you've ever seen, didn't he?
No, he had palsy or something, which made one side of his face drop.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah,
that.
It was a medical condition.
I take it back. I take it all back.
Exactly. It was a medical condition, which in the last few years he's had corrected with, you know, better forms of plastic surgery being induced. He managed to get it sorted, okay?
So we could be sitting next to him on the bus and we wouldn't even know who he was.
He doesn't look like he used to. I've known Lembit for years and I employed him quite a few times in radio to come on and do shows and all that kind of stuff, even when he was a politician, but I think he's gone off now and he's doing other things like investment in property and all that kind of stuff. Very good luck to him. But yes, he used to go out with Sean Williams, didn't he? The
Sean Williams, the very Welsh weather girl.
That's right, yes.
My abiding memory of Sean is one New Year's Eve, this is years ago, when she was quite high profile on television at the time,
right.
BBC, I think, from memory. And she was giving a weather report on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
She was wearing a gold spangled dress.
Right.
And over her arm that was closest to camera, she had dangling a little gold jeweled evening bag.
Right.
And I fell off the sofa laughing. I've never seen anything so funny as somebody giving a weather report with a gold sparkling evening bag hanging off their arm.
Well,
I just could not stop laughing for days.
Perhaps she was just trying to get into the spirit of it. You know, he can't really... labour for trying to. But anyway, old Lembit, he used to carry this mouth organ around, and if you stopped him in the street and said, "Lem, give us a tune," he'd give you a tune there and then. You know, he was just his sort of party trick and all that. But anyway, there we go. Now, I want to...
So there's no connection with the Cheeky Girls now between him
No. I don't know if he left Sean Williams for one of the Cheeky Girls, but he went out with them for 2 or 3 years, and he's talked about it often and said, no, it was a serious romance. Everybody said, oh, come off it, Lembit, you're a publicity seeker. You only went out with the Cheeky Girl because it was good for you at the time. And he said, no, it was a real romance and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, look.
Yeah, they always say that.
Exactly. That's his story and he's sticking to it. Talking about friends, girlfriends, boyfriends or any other friends, did you see that piece in a newspaper we mutually read about a lady who said, am I unusual when I say to people, oh, no, I haven't got a best friend. I don't want a best friend. I don't need a best friend. And all this about, oh, my bestie and all that, I find a complete bore.
Interesting. I do have best friends, actually. I've got two friends from school.
Yeah.
The three of us have known each other since we were 11.
Yeah.
One lives in Luxembourg, the other lives in Salisbury, so we don't see each other very often.
Yeah.
But whenever something happens, such as one of them, the one who lives in Luxembourg, Karen, her mother died this week, and the other two of us are straight there.
Right.
We drop everything when something happens. So we are very loyal to each other, and that's never gone away.
Yeah.
Another friend who I've known for 40-odd years and who's the godmother to my eldest daughter, we had a massive falling out recently over nothing, because all falling out, or fallings out, I should say, are over nothing, aren't they? Really?
Well, sometimes they're over major issues, which are big to one person but not to the other.
Yeah.
So what did you fall out over?
Well, it's a ridiculous thing about our birthdays, our respective birthdays, and our misunderstanding of the expectations of the other one.
Right.
We both kind of got it wrong. And it's a silly thing. And you just think, on one hand, life is too short to make a big deal of such a thing. On the other hand, if someone's your mate, you don't kind of do this. So it's a difficult thing. Do you just agree to draw a line in the sand and move on? Mm. Or is there always going to be that feeling of something's hanging over you and it's like the elephant in the room, yeah, as they say these days? So I don't know. I'm torn between, I think lockdown and being separated from a lot of our friends and family had a massive effect on us psychologically in so many ways, not least the fact that we realized we can actually do without quite a lot of people in our
lives. Yes.
Do we really want to rekindle a lot of those friendships?
No, I totally agree. I find friendships burdensome. I hope people don't think that I'm callous and cruel for saying that, but I've never really had a good friendship. I had a very good friend years ago. You know, we knew each other from, I would say, the age of about 18, you know, when we're going to college, till probably about the age of, it must be 20 years, I would imagine, about 20 years. And we fell out over the issue of Christmas presents for his and her children. They were a couple by then. And it just never rekindled itself. You know, sometimes if you, I don't know, raise criticism about, you know, a youngster or something like that, it can hit home very badly, be misinterpreted, and suddenly it's gone. But look, I've sort of shed all my friends over the years, and I don't mean that callously, but like you, I've moved around a lot in my life, and friends have been left behind here, and you've never, and you think to yourself, what is the point of getting in the car and driving for an hour to somewhere where this friend lives, or an hour and a half or something like that, and then going out and having a great lunch or something like that, and then maybe having to stay over because I don't like staying in people's homes, so I'd stay in a local hotel or something like that. What do you get out of it? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I do know what you mean. There's a lot of obligation involved in old friendships. And really, are we just doing things for old time's sake?
No, I think we're doing it because we feel we should for the person concerned. But I've got to the stage of life now where I think, look, I've got to think about number one. I don't have all the time in the world anymore and I don't want to do it.
Yeah, it has to be now at this stage in the game about what suits you,
yeah,
and how you spend what's left of your life wisely.
Yes.
And not feeling obliged to do anything at all, only doing things because you really want to.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I totally agree with that. Did you ever watch Rising Damp?
Yes.
Did you like it?
Because I got teased all the time about being, oh, Miss Jones.
Yes, exactly. That's what I mentioned. Because, of course, she's the most famous Miss Jones, after yourself, of course, Leslie Ann.
Was Frances de la Tour,
that's right,
wasn't it?
That's right. Absolutely.
What a magnificent actress she was, yeah, or is. I don't know. She must be still alive. She made a comeback in the Harry Potter, one of the,
that's right,
Harry Potter films.
She did.
She was a sort of gigantic school headmistress, I,
yes,
think.
She was, yeah. With a pointed hat, yeah, I think, didn't she? Yeah.
And didn't she fall for Hagrid? I mean, somebody had,
yeah,
to.
Yeah, absolutely. But so she was the leading female actor. The leading male actor, of course, was Leonard Rossiter, who later went on to make the Rise and Fall of Reginald Perrin, right? But the reason I'm bringing all this up is because the guy who created it and wrote it has sadly died. His name was... something Chappell. What was his name?
Eric
Chappell. That's it. Yeah, he's dead.
Or Chappelle. Yeah. I can't, you know, it was hugely popular at the time. Rising Damp, wasn't,
yes,
it? And of course, Richard Beckinsale also starred in that. Who very tragically died when he was about 30.
Absolutely.
He was one of the flatmates. If you have another look or another, cast your mind back over the scripts.
Yes.
It was horribly dirty old man.
Yes.
And Leonard Rossiter's character, Mr. Rigsby, yeah, was always lusting after the girls in the building, especially Miss Jones.
Yes, he was, yes.
A lot of it was very, yes, 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 it was very risque and suggestive. Mm. And he was somebody you wouldn't have wanted to meet on a street of a dark night.
No, exactly.
You know, there was something insidious and sinister about this character.
Yeah.
Leonard Rostin managed to bring great humour into
That's
it.
That's right.
But I'm not sure that those scripts would have got past the censors today.
Oh no, they wouldn't.
Given the way we feel about men preying on women.
Absolutely, and remember, the scripts were full of racism as well. Because one of the other, to remind our millions of listeners, Leonard Rossiter was the owner of a seedy sort of house full of bedsits, which he rented out to medical students, didn't he? And one of them was an extremely handsome black chap who, these days, stars in that TV series Murder in Paradise. Okay, but
He was called Philip.
Philip, that's right. Yeah, he was called Philip. Yeah,
very well to do. Wasn't
he was well to do, and the back story to him was that he was the son of an African prince, and his father had funded his medical education in England, and that's why he was here and all that. But all sorts of terrible racist attacks about, you're not, don't do it this way, do they, hey? and all this kind of stuff, which of course wouldn't get past the censors today and shouldn't get past the censors today, but it was a different era, and that's the way people used to like it. But nevertheless, you're absolutely right. And as for Beckinsale, such a tragedy. Hasn't his daughter gone on to be a great actress?
Kate Beckinsale, yes. Yeah. She was pretty high profile for a while. I haven't seen her in anything for some time, I must admit.
And also, just to let people know, they might not remember Rising Damp, but after that, Richard Beckinsale, went on to star in...
Porridge.
Porridge, thank you very much, yeah. With Ronnie, what's his name?
Barker.
Ronnie Barker, that's right. He was the younger lad in Ronnie Barker's cell, wasn't he?
Very clever piece of television, that
was.
Yeah,
it was.
It's interesting when you think about Rising Damp, it's being in the same vein as, was it Till Death Us
Do
Part?
Till Death Us Do Part, yeah.
With, what was his name? Alf Garnett.
Yeah,
you'd never get away with that on television now either.
And you shouldn't either, so.
No, I agree.
We're both agreed on that.
In fact, you couldn't even show those old episodes.
No, you couldn't, no. No, you're absolutely right. They wouldn't. Just getting back, by the way, to that Live Aid thing as the place where everybody wanted to be. I meant to say to you then, I'm sorry to have to go back to it, but if I was asked, what is the event at which you could have been, it's one that hasn't happened in my lifetime, like the first Olympics, and it would be the Battle of Britain, and I would want to be a Spitfire pilot running across the grass, jumping into my Spitfire and heading up into the blue skies of Kent over the English Channel to fight the Germans. Honestly, if anybody said to me, you go back in time to one event, what is it? That would be me. Seriously.
That's an interesting one. I tell you where I would have loved to be.
Yep.
On the moon, on the day of the moon landings in 1969.
Well, not much was happening.
No, but I'd love to have been there.
Exactly.
And I don't know if you remember this, but during the mid-80s, when we were colleagues on Fleet Street, there was talk, and this really was a serious conversation, about Richard Branson staging, this is long before the International Space Station or anything like that, but there was talk of Richard Branson staging a Live Aid-style concert in space.
Right.
And we were all discussing about, whether we would go, wanting to be chosen to go.
Yeah.
And people like Paul McCartney and The Who were, we wrote stories about it. They were mooted as being the sort of headline acts and so on.
Yeah.
If you think about it, they would never have got insurance
for
a gig like that, would they? They probably wouldn't get insurance now,
think. No, absolutely.
But now that they could do it, they could feasibly do it in the International Space Station.
Yeah. Well,
it's never going to happen.
Well, we've got to establish a space community first. Getting back to pop stars again, of course, we've got to talk about the Beatles. What about that story about John Lennon sent Harold Wilson, who was then the Labour Prime Minister in 1969, a War Is Over card, and he was basically taunting Wilson for, having never spoken up strongly enough against the Vietnam War and all that kind of stuff, even though Wilson refused the Americans' offer to send British troops. Excuse me. And Wilson, rather, sniffily, told his staff, don't reply to that one. Fancy not replying to John Lennon when John Lennon sends you a Christmas card because you're...
Well, hang on a minute. Does anybody reply to a Christmas card? The only way you reply to a Christmas card is to send the person who sent you one. Send them one back.
Maybe that's the case. But anyway, the story is that a member of staff in Downing Street who was tidying up came across the pile of cards of which Harold Wilson had written no action in green paint on the envelope, okay? And they noticed something strange about this one, found it was a card from John Lennon, and then asked the supervisor, if this was a woman, could I keep the card? And they said yes. And she took the card, took it home, and it's now on sale for 65,000 quid. That's not bad, is it?
Good God almighty, that is ridiculous. Yeah. Well, good luck. If anyone has enough money and is stupid enough to pay it for a rejected Christmas card, then what is the world?
Yeah, but it's signed by John Lennon. It's a Christmas card from John Lennon. War is
over. I get that. But is it? Well, here's a question, being provocative. Yeah. It may not genuinely be signed by John Lennon, because rock stars have always had teams of people signing letters and Christmas cards and fan club this and that. I remember Queen and Freddie Mercury doing
it. Yeah, sure.
You know, there's a guy called Peter Freestone who was Freddie Mercury's right-hand man for about 12 years. Yeah. And he used to sit and sign all Freddie's merchandise. Yeah. So you can never really be sure that a celebrity has genuinely signed something.
Well, except on this occasion, Lennon sent one to the leaders of all the 190 countries registered in the world at the time. So you've got the feeling that he probably did personally sign it. And I've just remembered now, the reason why the cleaner's attention was drawn to it was because there wasn't just a Christmas card in the envelope. There were two acorns. And Lennon was asking all the world leaders to plant the acorns for peace. And I think that's what turned Harold Wilson off.
That story's in my Lennon book. But I've got a very good friend called Michael Watts, who years ago worked at Melody Maker.
Oh, yes.
Long deceased music magazine. Yes. And he was quite friendly with John. He'd worked in New York when Yoko and John were living there. And they'd sort of established a bit of a loose friendship. And John wrote Michael a postcard after an interview Michael had done with John that appeared in the Melody Maker. John wrote to him, especially when he was living in New York. He was fond of writing to people back home. He was very attached to Britain, and he used to listen to the BBC World Service and all of that. And he wrote this postcard to Michael, which Michael left on his desk, and somebody nicked it.
Wow.
And we were having dinner not long ago, and he said, you know, I know the guy who took it, and I've asked him for it back because I could sell that now for a lot of money. And the guy claimed that he didn't have it anymore. But it's something you're not going to lose, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's right. I've got an admission to make, and I've never admitted this to anybody else before. When I was the news editor of the Daily Express, we got invited into Nick Lloyd's office, Sir Nicholas Lloyd, the editor of the Express, for a few drinks, excuse me, on the day before we broke up for Christmas. So it may have been Christmas Eve, but it might have been the Friday or something like that. And we had a few drinks. I was one of the last to leave, as always. And there was a Christmas card on Nick's desk from Mrs. Thatcher, signed by Mrs. Thatcher, a personal Christmas card, but it didn't say to Nick and Eve Pollard being Nick's wife. It was just signed Margaret Thatcher. So I took it, and I still got it, and I preserved it in, you know, a plastic sort of folder. And occasionally I get it out, and I tell people, this is my Christmas card from Mrs.
You stole a Christmas card from Sir Nick Lloyd.
Yes, I did, yeah.
And you kept it.
Yes.
And you've just admitted that on international podcasts.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes, I did.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. They'll be after you. Yeah. And Lady Eve will be on the phone after this, I tell you.
She certainly will. Where's our Christmas card? Yeah.
Yeah, I want it back.
Yeah. And so that was a false one. But you won't believe this. After I'd gone to Pakistan and flown there with Benazir Bhutto, when Benazir Bhutto retook the country, a million people met us at the airport and we got there. I wasn't the only one.
That is a good name drop, by the way.
Yeah, very good.
Benazir Bhutto.
Yeah, Benazir Bhutto. Yeah.
Amazing woman.
And there were about half a dozen journalists on the plane because it was very difficult to get on the plane. I had to pull all sorts of strokes and, you know, grease a lot of palms with silver to get on the plane to fly back with her. And I was there for about 6 or 8 days in stifling heat and all that. But I got on so well with her that for the rest of her life, sadly, she was assassinated, I think, 5 years later. She sent me a personal Christmas card to my home in England. And I've still got them. Amazingly.
Well, that is incredible. Mm. I don't have that claim to fame, but I tell you who used to send me a Christmas card every year for years and years and years. In fact, two people. Yeah. And I kept them. I do still have them somewhere because I know I haven't thrown them away. Yeah. One was Gloria Estefan, who I got to know when I went down to Miami to interview her after she was in a horrific coach crash right. and nearly was paralyzed.
Oh, terrible.
And she used to send me a Christmas card every year. And also Adam Ant used to send me every Christmas, but it wasn't a Christmas card. Yeah. It was a postcard, some sort of random postcard, but always came at Christmas. Yeah. Very distinctive handwriting. Mm. And I've still got those. I don't suppose they're worth as much as John Lennon's to Harold Wilson.
No, I wouldn't think it is. Right. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for having tuned in. Miss Jones, I can wish you only well for the days ahead, you know, spring has sprung and all that kind of stuff. So we're in good shape. And to the audience, thank you indeed for being with us. And we'll be back again with you next week.
Interesting, because I had quite an easy ride as a parent.
Right.
I think I was a bit kind of a good girl at school, really. I didn't get into trouble very much. Only on April Fool's Day, when we used to reorganise the school timetable and send everybody to the wrong classrooms. And my favourite trick was always putting cling film over the toilet bowl.
Oh, dear.
Lift up the seat. And
oh, Miss Jones, I can't believe you took part in such a seedy,
of course I did.
Sordid... absolutely revolting trick like that. Honest to God,
I'm sorry.
My view of you has changed absolutely completely now, Miss Jones, you know. And as for Beckinsale, such a tragedy. Hasn't his daughter gone on to be a great actress?
Kate Beckinsale. Yeah. She was pretty high profile for a while. I haven't seen her in anything for some time, I must admit.
And also, just to let people know, they might not remember Rising Damp, but after that, Richard Beckinsale, went on to star in...
Horridge,
thank you very much. Yeah, with Ronnie... what's his name?
Barker.
Ronnie Barker, that's right. He was the younger lad in Ronnie Barker's cell, wasn't he?
You stole a Christmas card from Sir Nick Lloyd.
Yes, I did,
and you kept it.
Yes.
And you've just admitted that on international podcasts.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes, I did.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. They'll be after you.
Yeah,
Lady Eve will be on the phone after this, I tell you.
She certainly will. Where's our Christmas card? Yeah.